Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On this Politics Monday, looking toward tomorrow, Election Day. Early voting around the country has been brisk. North Carolina voters set a record for turnout on the very first day of early voting, and it only got better. Given all the talk about how important this election is and how, given how divided the country is, the higher than normal turnout probably shouldn't surprise us. But what might still be a surprise is what this all will mean in the end. Which candidate or party will this early voter turnout help or hurt? What can we know about who voted early and who may vote tomorrow? And although the only real poll numbers that matter is the one voters participate in the voting booth, there are still those polls floating around out there giving folks hope, making some others nervous. Do they really mean anything? Are they accurate? Are things changing so quickly that these snapshots in time are rendered meaningless outside the moment the polls were conducted? A conversation about all of this now with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Dr. Michael Bitzer is back. He is politics department chair and professor of politics and history at Catawba College. And Mallory Newell is vice president of public polling at Ipsos. Thank you all for being here. Good morning. Welcome.
Morning.
Michael, I'm going to start with you. The numbers I just gave were middle week numbers and the very first day of voter turnout. I just heard you on the news say that 75% of, was it North Carolina or Mecklenburg County voters have already voted? Which one was it?
Well, it's North Carolina, and it's not 75% who've already voted. About a little over half have voted, but probably 75% of the people who are going to vote on Election Day have already cast their ballots. So I guess you could look at it like, we're starting the fourth quarter tomorrow.
Should this surprise us?
No, that's basically what it was 4 years ago. That was a different election because of the pandemic. Slightly more people did vote early in 2020 than this time, but it's still, I think, speaks to a growing trend of more people casting ballots early. 4 years ago, it was Democrats in huge numbers because of the pandemic. This time, Republicans have caught up because the GOP has made early voting a high priority.
A lot hinges in North Carolina in terms of which way the wind will blow in this election on Mecklenburg County. We are a blue county, but we have historically low voter turnout. Any reason to think that will change this time around, or has changed? Can we tell from early voting?
Yeah, I think there's some positive signs for Mecklenburg County. After early voting, just step back a minute, Mecklenburg County is the second largest in the state. It has the most registered Democrats, the most black voters. And it's been a persistent problem for Democrats over the last several elections that MEC has trailed voter turnout statewide. It's still that way. It's about 2 percentage points lower than the state turnout. But I think the gap, it looks like it may be a little smaller in 2024 than it was in 2020. There was a kind of over the weekend, I think, a late push. I think black voters turned out in pretty large numbers. That's going to boost Mecklenburg's numbers. So if you're a Democrat in Mecklenburg County, there are some reasons to feel optimistic going into Tuesday.
Michael, Steve just mentioned that Republicans have been turning out in high numbers for early voting. That's unusual. Usually it's Democrats who vote early and Republicans vote on Election Day. Why is this changing?
Well, I think as Steve mentioned, we are seeing the signals sent from former President Donald Trump, from campaigns, from Republican elites saying, bank your ballots, get your votes out early. And indeed, they have been. What is interesting, if you look within the data, is they're not necessarily bringing in new voters. They're shifting their voters from Election Day or later in the early voting to earlier in the voting. And as has kind of been mentioned, this is a new dynamic. We're basically evenly split between unaffiliated Republicans and Democrats based on party registration in the voter registration pool. We have never seen this before in terms of this new dynamic. So there's no making any predictions based on this data. It would be a fool's errand to try and figure out who is benefiting other than unaffiliated and particularly are really interested in this year's election.
So essentially, Steve, it's a third, a third, a third. And a big deal was made last week out of the fact that last week, independents became the, I guess, largest voting bloc. What happened? Why did we just know this last week?
Oh, well, yeah, in Mecklenburg County, unaffiliated registrations passed Democratic registrations in Mecklenburg County, kind of a historic moment, something that happened in the state a few years ago. Yeah, I think to Michael's point, the big change, when early voting started this year, Republicans jumped out of the gate really strong because President Trump encouraged it. But it's that what's kind of changed in the last week is that unaffiliateds have become really dialed into this election. And that is a bit, you know, they usually, just by nature of being unaffiliated, you tend to vote at lower rates. You're just not as committed. And their percent is still down, but they are really dialed into this election. It's a big change.
So what you're saying is that the Republicans are turning out for early voting more than the Democrats and even more than the independents, although the independents seem to have higher interest. Does that mean they'll show up on election day tomorrow, Michael?
Well, yeah. I mean, what we're seeing in terms of statewide dynamics, registered Republicans are 63% turnout rate, meaning over 6 out of 10 registered Republicans have already voted. Democrats at 58%, unaffiliateds at 50%. So we've got some room to grow. The partisans are certainly showing up, but this is a new day with the unaffiliated showing up. And, you know, again, we haven't seen this before. So we need to be thinking about what those results are going to be once Tuesday polls close.
Mallory Newell is with us. She's Vice President of Public Polling at Ipsos. We're going to talk a lot about polls, but Mallory, you wanted to chime in on this. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, good morning, everyone. I think it's also important to remember that, you know, obviously our world is becoming increasingly polarized, right? And more people tend to identify as Democrat or Republican now. But party registration sometimes kind of masks party identification, right? So those who don't choose to register one party or another, chances are that they still probably lean toward Democrat or Republican. And I think that's important to remember. And I agree in the caveats of reading too much into the early vote stats, especially considering that, you know, we don't know about the self-identification of how these people view themselves, right? And also early voting stats that are available vary widely state by state.
So, Steve, do we have any idea which way the independent vote in North Carolina or Mecklenburg County, for that matter, leans? Or is it just a crapshoot?
I think it's just a crapshoot. I have no idea. I'm not sure anyone. Michael, maybe you have broken it down, kind of where the unaffiliateds come from by county. But it's just kind of like, you look at, it's like I kind of think about it looking at a dirty swimming pool, you know, and I just can't see. It's just really murky water. I don't know. I don't know who these people are and who they're voting for.
So these people who are unaffiliated tend to skew much younger. They tend to be millennials and Gen Z. Gen Z is now the youngest voting bloc. They are 50% unaffiliated. That is a record in any generational cohort here in North Carolina. And so the dynamic, though, is among these two generational cohorts, millennials and Gen Z, they tend to lean more Democratic in voting dynamics in this state. So the big question in my mind is, yes, the unaffiliateds are making their mark, but you have to dive, as Mallory accurately said, you have to dive into it. And out of this generational dynamic, we're seeing a kind of battle of older voters, boomers and the silent, that are much more Republican in leaning, and the millennials and Gen Zs who are more Democratic in leaning. The issue is older voters tend to show up more by the end of the election day. And so that is, you know, one of those cross current factors we've got to take into consideration in this state, but we just don't know until the polls close.
Nationally, over the last several days, I've been hearing pundits say that the high Republican voter turnout for early voting is a very good sign for Donald Trump. So the question is it, or could the party with the highest amount of early voting turnout be disappointed on Wednesday morning, or maybe Saturday morning if we don't count the votes fast enough. In other words, are they coming out now and just cannibalizing who would have come on Election Day? And what has happened is in the past, and it's not going to get any better. What do you think? Michael.
I think certainly more Republicans shifted their vote earlier this year.
Right.
That was within the dynamic. We've seen that. So if you want to credit that as cannibalization, that is certainly an impact we are seeing already. The question is, who shows up tomorrow? And generally in this state, we have more registered Republicans, but if they've already cast their ballots, there's got to be somebody to replace it. The other dynamic that is really at play that we have no idea about, how many party defectors are there going to be? As Mallory indicated, partisanship is a huge driver in terms of the self-identification and vote choice. But if there are Republicans who are defecting, the non-Trump, the Nikki Haley voters, the anti-Mark Robinson Republicans, that's a whole new dynamic that we've got to take into account that we just don't know.
And then, Mallory, we have all the women. Women vote in larger numbers than men. There are more women in the population than men. And we have this last minute message, at least from the Harris campaign, to women saying, nobody knows who you're going to vote for when you're alone in the voting booth. Do you think women are going to decide this election, from what you can tell from polling?
Well, that's a great question, Mike. I think truly every election cycle, there is always sort of a storyline of the impact of suburban women or suburban white women. They remain an incredibly important voting bloc and an incredibly difficult voting bloc to pin down. You mentioned that there were stories this past week about how Republicans were turning out, and that bodes well for the Trump campaign. And I would say for every story like that, there was a story about how there's a 10 percentage point gap in women turning out to early vote higher than men, and that bodes really well for Democrats. There is a significant gender gap in this election, with women favoring Kamala Harris. And I think the question is, you know, which women could decide this election, right? Are we going to see higher turnout among young women, Gen Z women, women of color, right? Black women historically vote in very high numbers. Will we also see higher turnout among Latino women? Will we see that sort of white suburban woman block that is kind of one of the last vestiges of a swing voter turning out in favor of Kamala Harris and being convinced by some of these messages of your vote is secret and it's only yours? I think that remains to be seen.
Politicians tend to tout the polls, Mallory, when they're going in their direction. Other times they'll say it's fake. And a lot of people were puzzled, disappointed, or have lost faith in polls because of what happened in the Donald Trump-Hillary Clinton election cycle. Our polls, did you, first of all, let's go back to 2016. Did pollsters get that right? And are polls as accurate as we've thought they were? And I have about 45 seconds.
Sure. It's a question I get regularly, right? I think the polling industry has spent most of the last 4, if not 8 years, fixated on the errors of 2016 and 2020. Now, in both instances, you know, we were pretty spot on to the popular vote, which I think is important nationally. We've made some significant methodological shifts to capture the political composition of the country, shifts that worked pretty well 2 years ago in the 2022 midterms. But I think we should assume that polls have some error, even if we don't know the direction. What they are useful for is to highlight the hopes and concerns of the American people.
We have to take a break. I'm going to come back more and talk about these polls and how they're conducted and the shifts that you've made in just a second. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the roundup, the wrap-up of the race for 2024. today in advance of Election Day tomorrow. I don't remember what year it was. Steve Harrison's with us. He's our WFAE political reporter. Dr. Michael Bitzer is chair of the Department of Politics, and he's a professor of politics and history at Catawba College. And Mallory Newell is with us. She's vice president of public polling at Ipsos. A moment ago, Mallory, you mentioned that since 2016, pollsters have made methodological shifts. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we saw in 2016 was this huge swing of non-college educated voters in favor of Donald Trump. And so after 2016, I think one of the first things that pollsters did was take a look at how we were factoring in education into weighting our surveys, right? Making sure that our surveys reflected the educational composition of the country or whatever universe we were talking about. After 2020, I think those conversations evolved, and we've seen a big shift into including a political measure into our polling, right? So whether that looks like past vote, how you voted in 2020, for example, not only if you voted, but who you voted for. Also that, like I mentioned earlier, factoring in someone's stated party identification. So I think now, what we're seeing is that we need to make sure that there's some sort of political measure in our polling and factored into our weighting to account for the composition of the electorate in that way as well.
There's been this fundamental shift in the world in terms of digital technology. Most of us don't have landline telephones anymore. We used to have them. They used to ring all the time. People would answer them because we didn't know who was calling. And it would be a pollster, and we'd take the poll. Now, not so much, because now you have to find cell phones. And we are so polarized politically that people have become untrust. They don't trust the pollsters. They don't know who you are. They don't know what you really want, what your real agenda is, and they may not be telling you the truth when they participate, or they may not participate. How difficult has getting the information that you need to be accurate become?
I think not only are pollsters shifting their methodology in terms of what we factor in our weighting, right, like party identification, et cetera, but we're also shifting how we conduct the polls. You're completely spot on that people are not answering their phones, right? Phone response rates for polls I've seen are as low as 1-2%. So there is an open question for that. And, you know, are we capturing some sort of non-response bias, right? Who's actually picking up their phones? They tend to be older people. So we've moved to different methodologies. We at Ipsos here conduct all of our polling online, using a probability-based panel, which is sort of a similar methodology to phone, but we're reaching people via online surveys rather than actually picking up the phone and dialing them.
So over the weekend, a lot was made, Mallory, of this new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll showing Vice President Harris leading Donald Trump 47-44% among likely voters just days before the election. And that, I think, is still within the margin of error. But Ann Seltzer, who is the president of Seltzer and Company, who conducted this poll and is evidently considered highly regarded within the polling industry, and you're nodding in agreement with that, says it's hard for anybody to say they saw this coming. She, meaning Harris, has clearly leaped into a leading position. What should we make of? How much weight should we put on this? Is this considered an indicator of a change in sentiment in the Midwest and that great blue wall?
I think it's certainly possible, right? And it's hard with Iowa because this is not a state that either candidate has visited or paid a lot of attention to. And these numbers reflect, you know, essentially a 2008 level wave. Now, are we going to have that tomorrow? I'm not sure. But I do think that there is significance here in the massive shift that she has captured in her polling over time. And the one thing I would say about the polling in Iowa, right? I know that Donald Trump came out and you know, said that it was fake and that there was an oversample of Democrats. And that's simply not true. Right. One thing about
how do we know that's not true?
Yeah, because she shows her work and her evidence, right? Okay. In polling, that means being transparent about our methodologies, about questionnaires, about how your survey is constructed and completed. And they've done all of that, right? The methodology for this poll, the questions that are asked, the sample universe, who was actually interviewed, is all public knowledge. And that's really critical in the polling industry. Transparency is key.
Okay. Steve, candidates for president from both parties spent a considerable amount of time in North Carolina in the recent weeks, both in the urban and rural areas. Kamala Harris was in Charlotte over the weekend. Donald Trump was in Gaston County. In a digital world where we can see anything, anytime, anywhere on all these different devices, what kind of impact does it have for candidates to be physically on the stump in these little towns and these big cities? Is it worth the effort? Can they change minds? Do they motivate people to go to the polls and vote for them?
You know, I think that's a good question. In terms of is it worth the effort, I'm not sure what else they would be doing in a way. I mean, I think that's a great point, but you know, they feel they've got to do something. So, and if you look, Trump will have held four rallies in North Carolina in the final 3 days. That just shows how this is absolutely critical to him. And that was how he closed in 2020, I think, as well. But to your point, Mike, you know, if you think about two of the events that got some of the most coverage in the last couple of weeks, Trump's rally in Madison Square Garden was not in any swing state. Kamala Harris in Houston, Texas with Beyonce. So, you know, so many people get their news from TV or from snippets on their phone. Does it really matter if you're in North Carolina or another place? I'm not sure. I don't know.
I think, Michael, that Vice President Harris has been to the state more than 20 times in this election cycle. Donald Trump has been here a lot as well. I don't have a number on that, as have their vice presidential running mates and various different surrogates. That's an indication of how important the state allegedly is to them and to the outcome. There are lots of different scenarios. There are several different paths to 270 electoral votes for both of these candidates. Do they run through North Carolina? How important will we be when all is said and done?
I think we're a critical battleground state. I think we're more critical for the Republicans. If they lose North Carolina, it is a much harder path to 270. Not saying that it can't be done, but the odds become increasingly tougher. I think, you know, what we have seen is this state be a competitive but slight lean Republican state at the federal level and a competitive but slight lean Democratic state at the state executive level. And that combination just makes things so much more difficult. You know, we're a coin toss on a knife's edge kind of a state. I mean, whatever metaphor you want to use, it's all dependent upon who shows up. And that, to me, is the dynamic that we're dealing with this year and why Trump is in Raleigh today. And, you know, this has been the crux of get out the vote efforts. It's the candidate showing up and saying, I want your vote.
It's easy to understand, at least for me, and maybe I'm completely off base, Michael, and you can tell me if I am, obviously. It's easy to understand how the executive races, the statewide races in North Carolina, might lean Democratic because the individual district races have been so gerrymandered that they favor Republicans by design. But why would you have voters voting for a Democrat at the top of the state ticket for the governor, but then turn around and vote for Donald Trump for president? Why would that be?
Because we did it in 2020, and we have a very long history of doing that.
Yes, but why?
Go back 20 years.
Why?
Go back. No, no, no. Go back 20 years, Mike, to 2004. Okay. George W. Bush won this state by 12 percentage points. Would you consider that a battleground state? No. Mike Easley, the Democratic incumbent governor, wins by 12 percentage points. Would you consider that a, you know, competitive battleground race? No, they were blowout races, but we had a 24-point swing of swing voters in this state that has collapsed to about 3 to 4 percentage points. Mm. And yes, your base matters, but if you can convince that small sliver of the electorate, 1 to 2% can have huge consequences statewide.
So Lenny Borner, if I'm saying his name correctly, in the Washington Post yesterday, Mallory, wrote this. He says, it feels like a truism at this point that the election will be close. The last two presidential elections were effectively decided by 78,000 and 44,000 votes, respectively. This year's polls also point to a really close race. According to the Washington Post's polling average, every single swing state is within a typically sized polling error. That means we should be prepared for each one to go in the opposite direction of the one it is leaning in now. But the close polls don't tell the whole story, he says. It's not unlikely that if we see a polling error of a typical size, one candidate, Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, could run away with this election. And they go on to explain that pollsters have made changes that we've talked about here since 2020 that may bias the whole thing slightly towards the loser of the election. In other words, the polls may not be telling an accurate story. And they discuss something called herding, in which no pollster wants to be the outlier. And so it ends up making intentional choices that put them in line with what other pollsters say their results are. And so they may be biasing the count. Do you agree or disagree with that? What's your take on it?
Yeah, I think that herding is a very real phenomenon. And I think the Des Moines Register poll that came out over the weekend is a great example of what happens when you are outside of the herd, right? Everyone saw Ann Selzer's numbers that showed Harris up 3 points, which, by the way, 3 points is within the margin of error. So technically, that is a tie, okay? Outside of where the average is right now, and it exploded all over the internet and got a ton of attention and a lot of scrutiny. And so I think there is a very real phenomenon of, you know, do pollsters kind of all tend to move in the same direction for fear of that happening? Potentially. But what I think, Mike, is that this race has been very close for a long time, and the polling averages have shown remarkable consistency in that. And it's also worth noting that the swing states, North Carolina, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, you know, the seven battleground states that this is going to come down to, have all seen incredibly close races for a long period of time, right? It's been within a percentage point or two, and a margin of error in a state level poll is higher than that. So yes, there could be swings in other directions, but I think what these polls are doing and why it's useful is because it is telling us directionally that this is going to be a very close race, and it is going to come down to a handful of states.
Right or wrong, these polls are constantly being fielded and tabulated and released into the wild outside of the polls that are conducted by the political parties or by the candidate campaigns. What is their function? How should we regular voters use them? How should they be used by the media? And do you think that polls impact the outcome of an election? If you think Donald Trump's going to win, don't you want to vote for the winner?
I don't know that polls impact the election per se, but I do think that they can be a very useful tool to understand the concerns of the electorate, to understand the issues that people care about. And I think you're seeing that in the candidates' closing messages, right? Our polling at Ipsos has shown for a long time that the economy is the main issue. And Donald Trump has had an advantage when it comes to the economy. Now, historically, the candidate that does the best on the main issue and communicating that message ends up winning. But I would say that this is kind of an off-diagonal election, right? And the vibes have sort of shifted in Harris's favor.
Steve, why does Donald Trump have the advantage when it comes to the economy, when the economy is arguably better by every measure today than it was 4 years ago?
I think a lot of people give former President Trump a pass on the pandemic and what that did to the economy. And I think
it's arguably better today than it was 8 years ago, 7 years ago, before the pandemic, 5 years ago.
I think a lot of people think about how much, I think inflation is the main thing, and they think about how much things cost, how much a quarter pounder cost at McDonald's or just their grocery cart. And I think that weighs heavily on a lot of people, just a lot of people's views on this. And even though inflation, the rate of growth has gone way down, the prices are still higher than they were in 2019. And I think that's been been the basis for his campaign. I mean, that's been the main driver. There's other things like immigration, things like that. But I think just how much things cost has really shaped this race.
Perception is reality, Michael, obviously. So clearly the message is not getting through. Whose fault is that? Is it they simply, people will not believe it because they haven't experienced it? They don't care what the stock market is doing. They don't care that unemployment is low. They don't care that some of the other indicators show that we have the, as the economist said, our economy is the envy of the world. They don't care because the price of milk is too much. The price of gas was too much. It's down now. Is it that, or is it the Democrats don't know how to message?
I think it's partly what Mallory indicated, and that is the drive of partisanship. We see everything through partisan lenses. And the fact that, you know, if you look, I think within some polling, you will see the disparity of how people react and how people envision and how people see things based solely on partisanship. So that's one dimension. We are now, our self-identification is based on our political party affiliation. And I think that drives a lot of it. I think what we see in the heat of the campaign, certainly, Harris has made some inroads in that economic issue and the messaging. I think you see her closing the gap in some polls. Mallory can speak probably more to that factor, but I think that that's an important context to put into this. But, you know, at the end of the day, we are either D's or R's, and how we label ourselves oftentimes define what we choose to focus on, what issues are of utmost priority. And we have nationalized so many of these issues that whatever the party elites tell us to think, we will think that in terms of our partisan affiliation.
Is it the party
Absolutely.
Elites?
Absolutely. And we're capturing, we're capturing that in our polling, right? If you look at people's perceptions of the economy, and I would completely agree with you, Mike, that perception is now out of step with some of these macroeconomic indicators. Absolutely. But even perception of the economy, if you feel that the economy is doing better and things are turning around, you're much more likely to be a Harris voter or leaning toward Harris. If you feel like things are still in bad shape, you're going to be a Trump voter.
Mallory Newell is with Ipsos. She's the vice president of public polling there. We'd like Dr. Michael Bitzer is with Catawba College, a professor of politics and history, and Steve Harrison is with us. He's our political reporter here at WFAE News. More about the upcoming election and the results and the polling and more when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE at WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Before we get back to our discussion about what has happened so far in the voting cycle and what may happen tomorrow on Election Day, a lot has been made about the safety of poll workers. A lot has been made about the threats that have been coming in across the country for poll workers. Back in 2020, Charlotte Talk senior producer Sarah D'Elia spoke with Peter Hohenstein, a retired Charlottean who wanted to contribute to the electoral process despite the risk of contracting COVID-19 in that first year of the pandemic. And in 2020, when he was 68, it was his first time as an election worker, and the experience made an impression on him, so much so he decided to do it again for early voting this year. He was up in the university area, and he caught back up with Sarah to discuss how early voting went from his point of view as a poll worker this time around.
What's the atmosphere been like when people have been voting early?
The first few days, the lines, at least where we were very long. Almost an hour. After the first couple of days, it was down to mostly a half hour. People are excited. Some people are concerned. It's like, I want to get out here. I want to vote. I want to vote early. You hear a lot of discussion about, I drove by here on my way to work or my way from work or when I was out at lunch because I don't want to stand in line for 2.5 hours on election day.
What's been the biggest challenge of being an election worker this time around?
Every now and then in 2020, there'd be a slow time and you could sit down for 2-3 minutes and then get up and start showing the next person to the machine. I've only seen one time where it was slow for about 2 minutes. And then then what looked to be a bus from a senior center pulled up and just unloaded a busload of probably 12 to 15 individuals and say, okay, lines are back up again. And by the time they got processed through, the line had grown again.
I want to read to you a quote from yourself from the last time we did an interview. You said, I think this is probably the most important election in my lifetime. There's a lot I see in the political discourse and political tone over the last 3 years coming out of Washington that I really don't like. I think we need to change not only that at the top, but down at multiple levels. So how important is this election to you? And why do you want to keep doing this? This is not easy work. Sometimes it's really thankless work and you're on your feet all day. I feel like you must feel a little called to do it.
Yeah. And I remember saying to you in 2020 that I thought that was the most important election in my lifetime. I would like to revise that and say that 2020 was the second most important election in my lifetime, and 2024 is the most important election in my lifetime. There's a lot at stake, federal, state, and local levels. It gets to the point of not just about the politicians. It's what kind of a country do we want to be? So no, I think this is actually more important than the 2020 election. And I did remember saying that back in 2020, that I thought that one was. And maybe as I've aged, I've looked at things from a slightly different perspective. And, you know, what's it going to be like 30 years out? I'm not going to be here. But what's it going to be like for my kids and my grandkids?
Yeah. Do people make political comments when they come to vote, or are people quiet and kind of just go to the machine and get it done?
There were more political comments made in 2020 than in 2024. The number of people who walk in with a sample ballot that they've already circled everything on is higher than I remember in the past. I've seen people come in with typed lists of exactly who they're going to vote for. And I mean, they are holding their list in their left hand as I'm walking them to the machine and we get started. You can kind of see they're holding it and looking at the screen and holding it and looking at the screen to make sure that they vote for the right person. I think it's a more serious crowd.
What would you say to people that have thought about being poll workers before, but haven't ever done it before, but are thinking about it or on the fence about it?
I would say do it. And the reason I'd say do it is you will meet the people who work the polls are, again, a good cross section of the electorate. But they too are committed people who want to make the process work.
I spoke with a poll worker at where I early voted, and they told me that on election day they get there before the crack of dawn and they stay there until they don't have to. They cannot leave. They stay there right until midnight or so. Whenever they shut the machines down and fold them up and put them in a truck, so it's a big job. And they've encouraged people who are skeptics of our election integrity to become poll workers, so you get a firsthand view to see just exactly how it works. There are a lot of misconceptions about that.
These are the quiet guardians of our democracy. I cannot say enough about the people that make these elections run. It's your neighbors, it's your friends, it's your colleagues, it's people that want to see this great democratic experience continue, and praise them, please.
And Michael,
and I was going to say,
go ahead, Steve.
I was just going to say, I think one kind of silver lining to come out of 2024, no matter who wins, with so many Republicans voting early and seeming to have success doing that, I think that bodes well for voting in general, for our democracy. I think when there's not one method of voting that is seen as overly partisan, favoring another side, I think that, you know, there will be a push to have perhaps more early voting sites, or not a push to reduce early voting hours. So I think that's kind of a good sign. I mean, mail voting is still an overwhelmingly Democratic way to vote, but to have balance in early voting and election day voting, I think is just a good sign overall.
And there's a lot of mis and disinformation about almost everything that has to do with politics or science or anything these days. And part of the problem, obviously, is political polarization. But the other part is a lot of us just don't know how things really, truly work. And that includes our government. We don't understand the three branches of government or our bicameral legislature or what the president can and cannot do. And we get very frustrated. We don't understand what happens when you elect a Democratic or a Republican president and the houses of the opposite party, as is the Senate, and how nothing ever gets done, because we just don't understand that. And we also don't understand how the election process works, which makes us easy prey for people who would like us to think bad thoughts. We've talked a lot about polls today, and I'm wondering, the media likes polls because the media likes to concentrate on the horse race. And apparently so do listeners and readers and viewers. They'd like to know. But all are we doing, Steve, are we doing the people who consume us a disservice? Would we not be serving them better by ignoring the polls and concentrating on whatever the issues happen to be that we understand the voters are concerned about, what the candidates are talking about, and what, in fact, they are saying about them?
You know, it's interesting when Mallory was speaking earlier a couple of times, she kind of circled back on this idea that the best thing polls are for is to look at the underlying issues in the campaign, because, you know, they may be off by a little bit, but those are real numbers, what people care about, and really good insight. But unfortunately for people like myself, and I think millions of people, like, we are addicted to clicking and refreshing and, you know, over these numbers that never really change. I mean, they change slightly, but we're all addicted. The news business, a lot of it drives on clicks and engagement, and polls are a great way to do that in the fall.
And Mallory, you're always going to have a job as a result. So talk to me about I've heard a lot of talk recently about quality of polls, that some polls are better mm-hmm. than others. And you have to, when you look at a poll, you have to understand the quality. What does that mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would wholeheartedly agree. And again, just to go back on something that Steve said real quick, the horse race is just one tiny component of the work that me and my colleagues do, but unfortunately it gets so much outsized attention. And Mike, everything you said about, wouldn't it be better if we just understood the issues and what the campaigns are saying, polls do that, right? We test that and we report on that, but the horse race gets the most attention. Now, for your question on quality, I'm gonna go back to something that I said earlier in this program, which is that, you know, being transparent about your methodology, how you're conducting these polls, the questionnaires, and the assumptions that we're building these polls on are key, right? Some polls and some methodologies are better than others. And we need to make sure that if we are trying to take a truly representative snapshot of what the public thinks, that our polls are composed to look like the American public or to look like the electorate in a given state. Right. So factoring that in, I think, is incredibly key, and making sure that it's not just, you know, we're reaching a couple people on the street or like putting a poll up on Facebook Live and trying to pass it off as representative. Right. It's transparency and the willingness to stand behind your methodology and the instrument that you're giving to the public.
So, Steve, as we've said many times in this hour, the polls show a near tie between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump around the country, in the swing states, and certainly here in North Carolina. And depending upon which poll you look at, one is up while the other is down, and vice versa. But when it comes to North Carolina's gubernatorial race, Josh Stein has this very wide lead over Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, whose name was tied by CNN to making crude and racist remarks on a porn site several years ago. Robinson has denied that and is suing CNN for making those assertions. How much of that storyline do you think is contributing to this, what I last saw as a 52-31 divide between Stein and Robinson, with Stein ahead? And how much is simply because North Carolinians know Mark Robinson and don't like him?
Excuse me. I think before the CNN story, Robinson was trailing Stein by maybe 8 or 10 percentage points. That's kind of my guess, my memory. And then after the CNN story broke, the bottom fell out. I mean, the Elon poll that you just referenced, Mike, had the presidential race tied and had Stein ahead by 21 points. So the CNN story absolutely demolished Robinson's campaign. Will he end up losing by 20? Probably not. I have to assume a lot of Republicans will kind of, quote, come home in the voting booth and it'll be a little bit closer. But you know, I don't see any path for him to any path. I think the main question is not so much who wins the governor's race, but what is the impact on the races below the governor for council of state?
And what do you think?
I mean, are Republican voters going to punish their party for Mark Robinson and be more inclined to vote for Democrats for things like lieutenant governor and attorney general, perhaps? Or will they just maybe be a bit turned off and skip some of these races and go home? Maybe. I have no idea. But we'll have a very, very good idea very quickly on Tuesday night when we start seeing the drop off in the different races.
Do you see Mark Robinson or being a drag on the top of the ticket, Dr. Bitzer, or just maybe if there's any drag at all, he'd be a drag on the down ballot races?
I think the expectation is more down ballot at this point. But as Steve mentioned, if the margin of victory is somehow well outside of a norm, and remember the last time a gubernatorial candidate in North Carolina won by double digits, it was Pat McCrory back in 2012. So, you know, we have, you know, a couple of cycles so far of very tight gubernatorial elections. Yes, they go Democratic for the most part. But if this is a big blowout, you know, is the factor playing out in the AG, Lieutenant Governor, Superintendent of Public Instruction races as well? And is there any spillover at the top of the ticket from folks like Nikki Haley, Republicans, who have already said, I'm not going to vote for Donald Trump? I would have to assume they're not voting for Mark Robinson. What do they do down the ballot? Yeah. I think this is a new factor in terms of the partisan defections we just can't see until tomorrow night.
Mallory, an Ipsos poll released late last month indicates that voters see Vice President Harris as better at being better at protecting democracy, abortion, looking out for the middle class, and they view Trump as being better on the economy. And most registered voters say that the economy is the single most important or very important issue in choosing a candidate. But a lot of Democrats are hopeful that women will be motivated to vote for Harris, even Republican women, because of the Dobbs decision, which Trump has taken credit for, and because of Trump's recent comment that he would protect women whether they like it or not. Has there been any polling yet on that to see how women are reacting to that?
If there has, I'm not familiar with it. We've not done anything on that. But what I can tell you is, yes, Harris continues to have a strong advantage when it comes to some of the issues that women indicate are important to them, preserving our democracy and abortion and women's health care. I think what the Dobbs decision has shown us is that it can be a very effective way to galvanize turnout for Democrats. We saw that in 2022 and in some off-cycle races as well last year. So we'll see.
Okay. Steve, what do you think we should expect locally and statewide, for that matter, tomorrow night? Well, when do you think we'll know who won statewide races or even which presidential candidate took the state?
Well, I think one thing to remember is that in past elections, North Carolina would put out the early vote right at 7:30 when polls close. And then that wasn't allowed in 2022 and it will not be allowed in 2024. So, you know, we used to get this kind of instantaneous quick snapshot results of early voting. We won't have that this year, but you know, if my memory serves from 2022, some of the rural counties start to have complete tallies by 8:30 PM. Now, I don't think we're going to know who wins, but you can definitely compare those and look at a 2024 complete county to the same one 4 years ago and get a little bit of an idea of the way things are going.
I only have a minute left. Who made the decision not to release that vote instantly? Because part of the problem that people have is they wonder why in the 21st century with computers, we don't know at 7:31 who won everything, because the computers can do it like that, and yet we hold back votes. Why?
Well, I think the main question about why we can't know instantly is that you take a place like Mecklenburg County, we've got over 200 precincts, so they have to drive those results from pretty far places, from Mint Hill all the way into uptown or Cornelius all the way downtown. So there's just kind of a logistical issue of getting the electronic results in, but...
Because, Mike, we don't want election machines connected to the internet, right?
Right.
Thank you. You just answered your own question.
Okay. Well, I'm just throwing questions out. Sometimes I know the answers. Depending on the results, will we trust the polls, Mallory? I have 5 seconds.
I hope so.
Okay, that's the good answer. Mallory Newell with Ipsos, Dr. Michael Witzer with the Catawba College, Steve Arison from WFAE.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.